I think all three speakers will talk on this subject from different angles. And so, rather like looking at a mountain. If one sees it from one view, it may look like a cone. And one may think one knows that mountain quite well. But as one begins to walk around the mountain, it may lose its cone shape and suddenly become a kind of longish plateau-like erection. If one then goes round again, it will look different again. And one really does not know the shape of the mountain until one has actually circumambulated it and seen it from all its sides and in all its aspects. And so perhaps those different talks on the heart of Buddhism are each individually different, but each amplifying each other. Don't know who was here last time. And the next talk is then again in a fortnight, which is the last one. And personally, I would like to stick to that heart of Buddhism and start right from the beginning. Buddhism is one of the great religions. It is listed as in the Oxford Dictionary as a religion. But with religion we come already into a slightly difficult thing, because it is not a religion of belief as we are used to think of with our Western conditioning. But Buddhism is a religion of experience. And with that very word of experience, we are already in difficulty, because this experience has been rather coupled with Buddhism as something which we hope kind of throws us out of ourselves into some kind of other state. And therefore we are more inclined to think of religious experience as something like a cathartic experience or a high. And this is not what a religion of experience or Buddhism stands for. But we can take the experience in the sense of an artisan, a craftsman, or a sportsman who has learned the skill of his art or craft or sport and is dedicated to do it, does it and continues doing it for the love of it. And so, contrary to our Western Christian Judea-influenced ideas about religion, a book religion revealed once for all, and that must be believed, the Eastern religions are dedicated ways. There is no God in Eastern religions. No supreme creator. And perhaps it is also useful in our irreligious age to ask ourselves what religion actually means. Because we have not necessarily been born, and certainly not the younger ones, to an actual sense of religion. Perhaps one could say that it is a quickening, that it is life-giving, because religion relinks with what is, relinks the known, that we think we know at least, with the unknown. And it also seems, if we look through all the ages of history, that man cannot thrive without religion in this sense of quickening, in this sense of relinking. And that whenever the religious values become obsolete or get lost, there is a general sense of loss of meaning, of unrest. And out of this, it seems then that an inferior object is substituted, that takes on the features of the spirit. And this is always associated, this substitution of an inferior subject is always associated with fanaticism, with intolerance, and with gullibility. And with this, as a further turn of the screw, my opinions, my views about it, which then take on the semblance of the spirit. And when we then come to that intolerance of my views, my opinions about it, then we can already see what has actually happened, and that is that unbeknownst to myself, the eye has almost usurped the place where once the spirit throned. And when this has happened, when this calamity has befallen us, then all reason is somehow lost, has gone into a limbo, and cannot be retrieved. History is full of such examples, and it is useful to look at history for that purpose, because we also live in such an age where religion and the religious values have been lost, and we have to be very careful and very humble to find our way back to that quickening, to that relinking sense of religion. Where the inferior, not spiritual subject has taken over, there is invariably strife and polemics and destruction. Somebody said, and rightly, that if the dogmaticians meet, those who hold their own views and discuss on the subject of religion, there is always great argument. But when the practices meet, of however different persuasions, then there is a nodding in agreement. When the practices meet, there is a nodding in agreement. So it comes down to the actual practice of doing it, not of what is done, but what is learned through the practice. Then we all understand each other. So whenever it goes into the polemics, then it is the opposite of the enlivening, widening, warming, relinking effect of religion. In Buddhism, this is beautifully shown by the story of the Buddha himself. Not the god, not the superman, but the man, like we are, who by his own efforts dedicated to these efforts that he made, awakened and became the Buddha, which really only means the awakened one. And in his own words could say that he had found nothing new, but only rediscovered an ancient path leading to an ancient city. And for the rest of his life, showed, lived, and taught that way. The Buddha himself summed up his teaching as, "Suffering I teach, and the way out of suffering." The curtain. Fortunately, life is not only suffering, yet suffering is basic to life. And it is basic also to our planet on which we live, and which is diurnal, where day and night alternate, light and dark, and where there is joy and grief, and where there is happiness and unhappiness. And so, not surprising, suffering itself is also twofold. there is the inevitable that we all know, a toothache or a cut finger or a broken leg, the physical side. And there is also the inevitable mental suffering, the very true grief about loss of somebody we love. And there is also the suffering of split agony and split loyalty that most of us at one stage or another have experienced. These are not to be brushed aside and saying it does not exist, but they do exist. They are part and parcel of life. But there is also, and this is the other component, my resistance against that suffering. Now, my not wanting to suffer, my wanting to have my will, and this resistance adds immeasurably to what is inevitable in suffering. So we can say that suffering is just as much part of life as joy is. But since we are eclectic and do not resist the joy that comes our way, but resist the suffering, it is as if we were rejecting half of life itself. And it is this unlived life which we have rejected that then piles up against us as fear. And the more we refuse our share in what is grave and constant in human experience, which is both joy and suffering, the more we refuse that one side, the more it piles up against us. The more we resist it, the more we suffer. This is where Buddha started his teaching, that suffering is real, that it exists, and that what is inevitable in it needs to be lived. My resistance against it, which makes it much worse, is unnecessary. To that extent, I suffer truly only from myself. And what is that resistance that I have against the suffering, against what I do not like, against the inevitable, my non-acceptance of it, and my wanting to have it my way? This in Buddhism is simply called this wildness that is in us, is called the three fires. The three fires of desire, greed. Desire is perhaps better. Anger, those things that flare up suddenly, quickly, and where I must have awe, or where I want to hit out. These are the fires. And the third fire is delusion, that basic delusion from which every eye suffers. It is with these three fires that the suffering has very much to do, and will come back to that when we have rounded off the basic Buddhist teaching. For by his own experience, the Buddha found that the fundamental cause of suffering is what I do not like. And he taught that since everything changes, as long as there is a strong sense of I, there must be suffering. Everything changes, one of the signs of being. And when we hear this, we smile and say, yes, goodness me, of course we know that naturally, long since known it, well-known fact. And it's not only just a momentary, we know only too well that seas dry out and mountains are worn away, and we take it with great equanimity and smile about little statements like this, which are so obvious. But are they really so obvious, so neutral, when they are not in those vast cycles of drying out seas and wearing away mountains, but when it happens suddenly to me at this moment, that when I want something, it is suddenly snatched away from me, or when I am stuck with something that I do not like? Do I not feel then... I must get rid of it. I must get rid of it. And do I not feel underneath all this I am stuck with this for an eternity? There I cannot accept the change. Then I do not let so easily go. And therefore, with all the Buddhist teachings, they are not meant as abstractions somewhere over there. They are always to be looked for and found in our ordinary daily lives as we live them, right in our normal daily round. Because this is how we experience them. And this is, if we are careful and really ponder what the Buddhist meaning is, how we can extricate ourselves from it. Not by getting what I want, but by the sufferer, I getting a little bit more out of the way. So these are the three signs of being. It's the Buddha taught from his own experience. Since everything changes, as long as there is a strong sense of I, there must be suffering. And with this fact of suffering, one of the other great Buddhist teachings starts, which is known as the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, and it is no good denying it. And the way out of suffering, the Buddha himself, suffering I teach in the way out of suffering. The way out of this suffering is by working out the cause of suffering. And the cause is I. How did the Buddha work out his own problems? How did he extricate himself from that sea of suffering? By evading his problems, by avoiding them, by looking the other way. If we look at his life story, this is by no means the case. He faced his problems when he found them. He kept on facing them. He kept on suffering them. He did not turn away from them. And from this, perhaps the most profound connotation of the middle way arose, of going right through one's sufferings until they are suffered out. Facing our own problems as the Buddha faced his, suffering them, our own problems, as the Buddha faced and suffered his, willingly and with open eyes, because only that way can we learn. And with this we come to still another sense of suffering and another meaning of suffering, which we have linguistically too, in phrases like, I suffer you to draw near. This is how we are to face our problems, our sides which we do not like to see inside ourselves, those things which we would rather be rid of, not to try to evade them, not to try to get rid of, but literally to suffer them, to draw near, and to suffer from their proximity. Because what we know and are aware of, that we can deal with. What we refuse to see, that inevitably creeps up from behind and whacks us over the head. And in Buddhism, that clear seeing and that courageous seeing is very much suggested. So this is the other sense of suffering, of allowing that suffering to happen, to draw near, that suffering which is in our own problems, that acceptance of it rather than a rejection of it, though it hurts. Suffering exists, and the cause for this suffering, to a great extent, is I, my non-acceptance. In Buddhism it is said that what has a cause, it has a beginning, and what has a beginning invariably has an end. And so, the cause of suffering being I, that cause having a beginning can also be worked out. I can be sloughed off, suffered through. And this is the way out of suffering. Working out our problems, suffering them out, not by refusing, but by accepting them. And so that this way can be walked rightly, the Buddha taught the Noble Eightfold Path, which starts with right seeing, so that we can put our feet, for the first step at least, on that path, and goes then through right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right concentration, and right contemplation. And you will have found that there is always the prefix right there. And the I that wants to start that path always thinks, now I must do it right. I must do it the correct way. But this is not meant by this careful wording of right, because that would only then give I greater strengths again. And one of the great teachings of Buddhism is precisely that that I is an illusion, that I cannot do it as I think I am, as I want to have it, because that is all connected with the primary delusion. And so that right is meant rather in a sense which is not foreign to our own religious background either, of I giving myself to the doing, of I totally giving myself, surrendering myself to the doing. If the seeing is right, then my giving myself to the doing will be right too. And particularly that one step which is called right effort is a difficulty, because it is always my doing it, rather than the total effort is my totally giving myself to it. Whenever you come across those steps of the Noble Eightfold Path and you see that right, please think it is not I doing it rightly, but it is I giving myself as completely as possible, again and again, do it. This is the heart of Buddhism. And as the very word heart shows, it has nothing to do with mind or mental constructs, which are always connected with me and mine, and hence with I. And it is therefore also not connected with anything I fancy or hot-headedly want to have. And it is also not intellectual gymnastics, but it is the true desire of our heart to be weaned by means of walking the Noble Eightfold Path, by means of a religious practice which is giving myself to it. The true desire of our heart is to be weaned from its own wavered wildness, those three fires that flare in the heart, not in the mind, from our own short-sighted, selfish appetites, lusts, rages, and not only from our crude desires and emotions, but from the much more difficult, from the much more pernicious ones of our deeply ingrained views, opinions, and ideas. This weaning is not an easy thing, and it needs careful and gentle practice, so that the wildness that lives in us slowly begins to change into warmth. And so the Buddhist way is not a clinical, a mechanized, an artificial, a mental process or system that leaves the heart cold, but it is a courageous acceptance of all our human traits that are in us, and the suffering that they entail and cause us and to others, as suffering them ourselves without letting them rip, and yet without repressing them. The true middle way of patiently enduring, suffering their presence, in and from the heart. And it is this which little by little grinds the eye away, and thus effects a true transformation. There is a saying in Northern Buddhism that the passions are the Buddha nature, and the Buddha nature is the passions. Do not think it is the same. I let it rip, everything is all right. And this is not the case. It is only the same energy. As long as there is an I, that energy is misshunted and comes out into our wild emotional upthrusts, eruptions, flares, and passions. When the I is not there, then it has reverted to what it always has been. And when the I, out of that total energy, clasps just a few things and says, this is it and this is what I want, then no transformation can ever take place, because there is too much left outside. And this is why it is so necessary to patiently and with open eyes and willingly to suffer through all of our problems, and to accept back into ourselves again all those faces that we prefer to see outside rather than accept them inside ourselves. Because though we are truly unique as individuals, we are also human beings, and we share with each other the best and the worst that is possible in human nature. And so that the worst cannot flare up and outside and work havoc. The Bodhisattva act begins at home too. We have to accept and endure it inside ourselves until it is worn away, gentled. And so, if we look at Buddhist literature, at Buddhist books, where we so often find the term mind, I really think that nothing has done more harm to an understanding of Buddhism in the West than the mistranslation of this crucial term, which is best perhaps be thought of as heart, into mind. Buddhism is not a dry, arid, negative system of denial that kills the living spirit, but a very real way that touches the heart and reaches the deepest roots of our being. It is a religious way of relinking us again to our origin and thus making us whole again. It is a way certainly of suffering. Suffering I teach, and the way out of suffering. It is a way of suffering. Suffering our individuality, our likes and dislikes. Suffering our common humanity and the difficulties and wildness that is in that. And suffering from our usual human lot, which cannot always have what it wants. And in the end, suffering out the sufferer I himself. And with this, to arrive on the yonder shore of no I, anatta in Buddhism, the total transformation which is not possible as an I to experience. This is where the rub is. I want it. In a way, I also fear it. I can never experience it. Its very condition is the absence of I, as I know myself. And it is therefore quite useless to try to speculate about that state, because whatever I may think, hope, idealize about it, is all connected with I, and its very condition is the absence of I, as I know myself. But this absence of I, as I know myself, and which I cannot conceive, but which comes about in the course of the practice, and not overnight either, this has enormous consequences, for just this I is the cause of our alienation, is the cause of our lack of identity, the cause of our fear, and the cause of our loneliness. Because this I is exclusive. It is very small, however much I may think myself the center about which everything ought to turn, but the fact is that there is very much that is other than I, and which can and does often interfere with what I like. And so the other side of I, if I'm courageous enough to look, is fear, is insecurity, is that lack of communication of which we hear so much nowadays. Because I is grown into itself. It can really not communicate. It can only think of its own things. Alienation, lack of identity, fear, loneliness, these are the other faces of I, if we really look at it. And the way out of suffering, because we suffer from all of this, and the heart of Buddhism, therefore, is that by walking this way of practice, by following the footsteps of the Buddha, not blindly imitating what he did, but by facing and suffering our own problems, our own emotional difficulties, as willingly and as courageously and as continuously as he did, and doing so with open eyes, that the mistaken sense of I loses, begins to lose, let's put it carefully, its tenacious hold on us. And with I getting weaker, there is restored to us our birthright, our real identity, which is not I. And with that, there is an end to all loneliness, alienation, and fear. And instead, there is the warmth and relationship that comes from that true seeing with which the first step of the Noble Eightfold Path starts, and which swings back through all its steps to that really true seeing, which is called in Buddhism the great wisdom, and which warms the heart, hence the great compassion. That true seeing which comes from the heart, which is not mine, but ours. And it is hence not for me alone, not for myself alone, but for the sake of all beings. And the joy is in this. And hence it is also said of the Buddha's way that it is lovely in its beginning, lovely in its middle, though it has its rough places too, and lovely in its consummation. May we all walk it rightly and prove it true and be happy together. This I wanted to say about the heart of Buddhism, and I wanted to make it as short as possible, because the heart is not a long talking about, but a pointing. And I thought that possibly we could have a good long discussion afterwards. Thank you.